Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and legacy of Pauli Murray. A poet, activist, lawyer, professor, and priest, Murray was a prolific and passionate writer. She exchanged letters with Eleanor Roosevelt and inspired the likes of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Murray's 1950 legal book, States Laws on Race and Color, became known as the Bible for civil rights lawyers. And her writing was cited in the Supreme Court's landmark 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education. As a poet and memoirist, Murray wrote eloquently about Black life in America. Her poem Dark Testament was the guiding force behind the American Writers Museum's past exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. You can now explore a virtual version of Dark Testament on our website. Murray is also featured in our special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, currently on display. This exhibit and programming series explores the profound ways writing reflects and influences our understanding of religion. Murray's lifelong spirituality informed her sense of justice, and in 1977 she became the first Black woman ordained as an Episcopal priest. For this episode, we are joined by two women who knew Murray personally. Rosita Stevens Halsey is the president of Preserving Pauli Murray, LLC, and Pauli's niece. Lucille Ward Walker is the executive director of the Southern Maryland National Heritage Area. Lucille's parents, who were also involved in the church and civil rights movement, were friends and colleagues of Pauli. You can learn more about our guests and their work in the episode description. Rosita and Lucille are interviewed by Nate King, content and exhibits manager at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place February 23rd, 2026, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Rosita and Lucille, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm very much looking forward to talking to Pauli Murray with you both and sort of hearing your personal relation with Pauli and sort of how you engage with her work. Before we get into too much, could you each sort of introduce yourself so our listeners know who we're speaking with and maybe give a little brief intro into how you first encountered Pauli and her work?
Oh, I should defer to Rosita. Oh, okay. She knew Pauli longer.
Rosita, maybe we can start with you.
My name is Rosita Stevens Halsey, and by accident, I guess, I'm the niece of Pauli Murray. My mother was her youngest sister, named Rosetta Rose, and that's how I got the name Rosita, Little Rose. Pauli and I met when I was about 2 years old. She was about to graduate from Howard Law School in Washington, D.C. in 1944. Of course, I don't remember that encounter, but I'm sure she probably did. And so that's the first time that I know that we met. And that was the beginning of a family relationship.
That's lovely, Rosita. Yes, I'm Lucille Walker, Lucille Ward Walker. And I knew Pauli since I was a girl, probably 10 or 11, when Pauli first came to St. Philip's Chapel to be a seminarian. And I knew her all through my girlhood and young adulthood. And she passed after I had graduated from college. But really, in so many ways, I know her. She was a constant presence in our family. I knew her dog, Roy, very well. And she and my mom had a very close friendship. And from my understanding now, it was after Louise had passed. And my mom was a very warm, maternal person. And I could see them connecting also in their strength. My mom and my dad both were civil rights advocates and women's rights advocates since very early on. And so they shared a passion for justice. And it was just an honor to be part of that world.
Well said, yeah. And Lucille, I know when I met you earlier in Washington, D.C. for to pick up some items that are in our current special exhibit, America Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you also attended the same church as Pauli?
Oh, yes, St. Philip's Church in Oquasco. And that came about because, I mean, that was a church that her family had been involved with. Her and Rosita can speak, of course, to all family matters much better and broader than I can. But my parents, being the parents that they were, which was pretty remarkable, saw in the 70s, early 70s, a lot of the racism that we were being exposed to, my sister Beth and myself, just in terms of not getting to know folks of different type, and they didn't want us influenced by any of that. And so they found this wonderful little church that had been built by people that had been enslaved or formerly enslaved, St. Philip's Chapel, and asked if we might attend a service or two, just trying to give us exposure to as many people as possible. And oh my goodness, we fell in love with this church, m amazing people. And they welcomed us, and they didn't have to. And it was a time of great strife for everyone, and these people were suffering a lot more than other people were suffering. And but they welcomed us, and it was one of the most profound religious experiences of my life because the church meant something. It was a lot of doing in the community. It meant something spiritually, but it meant something actively. And I think it was a great match for Polly, of course, to come back there. And then that's when she and my mom particularly hit it off. It was great.
Of course, a lot of my experience with Aunt Polly was as a family member and a niece. And I really didn't understand until after she had died how important her work was and many of the things that she had done. Because most of the times when I saw her, it was either what we called her Washington, D.C. headquarters. So my mother and an older sister, Mildred, were the only siblings that lived in Washington, D.C. for any sense of time. So whenever Aunt Polly was going from the north to the south or going or coming to do government work or go to the White House or many of the things she did that were centered around Washington, D.C. She always stayed with relatives. And so we dubbed it that we were her Washington, D.C. headquarters. So we were lucky from the standpoint that we got to see her quite often because she did have a lot of ties to the Washington, Maryland, Baltimore area. And also, she would usually stop and spend the night or several days if she was heading to North Carolina or other places. So most of my interaction with her and my memories of her, I was lucky in that she came to Washington quite often. And one of the things that Lucille mentioned, all of my life when my mother would talk to me about seeing Aunt Polly in the summer and seeing her in the country, I always assumed was Durham, North Carolina, because that's where she had grown up. And south of the Mason-Dixon line to me, I always thought of as country. So it was just amazing to find out how much time she had spent in Croom, Maryland, where I met Lucille, and which is only 13 miles from where I have been living for about 25 years. So I've learned a lot just even recently in my journey to learn more about her.
And Rosita, to that point, yes. And getting to know Rosita has been such a gift. It's so nice when you can share experience, and there's no one else other than my sister, who's wonderful, that I can really share any of these memories with. But yes, I'm also the executive director of the Southern Maryland National Heritage Area, and we are so honored to be able to include Polly in our story, as to one of the reasons we became nationally designated by the U.S. Congress, and what a chance to give back.
Yeah, the work both of you do is so great, but and passionate and important. And I see a lineage from Polly Murray's work as well in that. And you both have kind of mentioned, Rosita, I'm especially curious, the like you said, you knew your aunt well, but not Polly Murray, the poet necessarily, or didn't know of that aspect of her work. I'm curious as when you did sort of encounter that as an adult, a young adult, or whatever it was, what was that sort of like for you? And Lucille, I'll extend this to you as well, as knowing Polly in a very specific, personal, intimate way, but then learning about how the impact she has had and how many people have read her work and felt inspired to do something different and make a change. What was that like as you were sort of going through that learning experience and still are to this day?
I always knew from just interacting with her that she was brilliant, very unusual, very bold, very assertive. And I knew she was a poet and a writer and a lawyer. And I always try to share it when I'm talking about her, but I had the opportunity to visit with the First Lady. During that time, Aunt Polly had just published Proud Shoes. So when I went to New York, she shared that with me. The book had been out only a couple of months, and I knew that she felt she was dedicating the story of our family to my generation, to her nieces and nephews. So it was wonderful to get a chance to talk with her about it and to get a copy of the book and to be able to ask her questions. I was an impressionable young teenager. And so that was really the first time that she and I ever got a chance to talk about her work as a writer and her interest in family history.
That's wonderful. I think Rosita, as with you too, we've talked about this, the two of us, that there's so many questions we'd like to go back and ask Polly. I mean, there's an innumerable amount of questions, and I just knew her as this amazing individual that just was naturally at home with our family. Would come and my mom was one of the first women who ran against another woman for the U.S. Congress, and Polly was stuffing envelopes one day. And I've told this story before, and I'll get to the writing part of this. But my grandfather, who was kind of a cowboy, my mom's mother father was there, and he said, Polly said, "Hey, Cy," that was his nickname, "you can help us stuff these envelopes." And he said, "Well, that's woman's work." And without missing a beat, Polly said, "Well, that's all right, Cy. We'll make you an honorary woman." And then my mom and she were like rolling. I mean, like they had such a sense of humor, the two of them. But my father and she was very androgynous. And as you'll note, Rosita and I both knew Polly as she, right? And so my dad and she would each have a pipe in the evenings. And we would often read books. And Polly was very modest in a lot of ways. Yes, bold and strong and out there and fighting, but she personally was a modest person. And when Dad wanted to read some of her work out loud when she was there, she was kind of like, "Oh, no, you can read somebody else." But we read her a lot when she wasn't there. And that's the only reason I got kind of familiar. I mean, it started with poetry, but we all were given our own copies of her book by Polly and Proud Shoes. And to read those was really fascinating. And as I got older, when you talk about what does it mean, I am not part in any way. I'm an outsider to the Black experience. But when I think about the complexities of who Polly was, it wasn't just the Black experience. And now knowing from history the other struggles that she had, the other, identities within her that she was working with, the fact is that that makes it even more amazing because she couldn't be confined by being Black or white or indigenous. She couldn't be confined by being, male and female. She wasn't one thing. You couldn't put Polly in a box. She descended from those that enslaved and those that were enslaved. I mean, there was no box she fit in. And I do not know how you walk through the world where you are so complex and yet you don't present yourself as anything other than warm, witty, strong, and a fighter. I don't know if Rosita would agree with that, but and I didn't, I grew up in a household where it wasn't, sure, she smoked a pipe with my dad, but we didn't, I only looking back do I see, all of that richness. And also in her writing itself, I was looking at one of the poems the other day, and I'm not part, again, what I was saying about the Black experience at all. And so I don't want to just compare her in any way to Black writers because she wasn't a Black writer. She was a writer, right? But there was something about that experience, I think, that must infuse her work, because I hear in the way she would talk, Rosita, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I hear a little bit of like the cadence of like a James Baldwin, the way he kind of talks, you know, the kind of the way he turns a picture around so you see it from the other side, or like a Maya Angelou, you know, where you hear that kind of rhythm that where Polly had sort of a prophetic, you know, sort of integrated with her theology. Maya Angelou, the kind of the passion that she brought to her language. And I picked up this one poem the other day that I remember my father read, and it's only four lines, but it was so funny thinking of my father reading it, because he was born in 1912. I'm the youngest, let's just put it that way. He was an older Southern man, right? But reading this, but I loved it. It's called Color Trouble. And if you dislike me just because my face has more of sun than yours, then when you see me, turn and run, but do not try to bar the sun. I hear Maya Angelou in that. But not in any way reducing Polly to, like, I just hear the different kind of experiences there. But I went off on a tangent, probably.
But well, I'm glad you brought up that poem, because that's one of my favorite as well. And how you mentioned Polly doesn't fit in any box, that extends to her writing as well. Like you said, she's a writer through and through, and that's a poet who, as you mentioned, Dark Testament, that was the inspiration for the title of one of our recent temporary exhibits called
Yes.
Dark Testament, A Century of Writers of Black Writers on Justice. And so there's the poetry, there's the legal work that Polly did, her book, I forget exactly what it's called, but it was cited in the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education.
The state laws on race and color.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, the Bible of the Civil Rights Movement, I've heard it referred to as. And Lucille, you were just mentioning the sort of voice that comes across in her writing. And as you both know, Polly's featured in our current special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. And in that one, we kind of look especially at her time as a priest, as the first Black woman ordained as an Episcopal priest. And I'm curious if either of you, because you also, spoke with her, in person, and the sort of the artistry of the preacher or the sermon as both a written document and one that is meant to be spoken. I'm curious I don't know if I have a question necessarily, but what you said, Lucille, got me thinking of what was she like as a preacher as well, as what sort of presence did she have in the churches?
I would say, first of all of her life, she was very involved in the church. And a lot of people ask, well, why, you know, in her 60s, did she decide to become an Episcopalian? She was born an Episcopalian, and she was a church goer because Aunt Pauline and Aunt Sally were founders of St. Titus. So she had always been influenced by the church, and she had also been called a child of destiny and twice and by a bishop. And so she always had a sense of spirituality and a sense of inclusion in terms of all people and feeling that we were all children of God. What I found so amazing once she became a priest was how deeply her thought process was about religion. Now, I don't think, will ever get away from being bold and assertive about things she disagreed with. So she was upset with the fact, even as she went into seminary, that the church didn't allow women to become priests, and that they could only have lay positions. And she knew that when she finished her studies, she might not be able to ever become a priest. So that I also feel, though, because of the way in which she attacked the law and the way in which she advocated, that she felt that would change. And even while she was in seminary, she was involved in advocating for women. But what I found as I was doing research, I was just amazed at the sermons and speeches that she had written, none of which I had ever heard. And I was so glad that Dr. Penn and I think five or six other theologians and scholars had interpreted much of it, because she was a very deep and complex writer. And it has taken me much more time to study that part of her writings as opposed to her journals and her legal theories. And I find probably least knowledgeable about all of the things that she wrote. But I'm still working to get through the book of her sermons and speeches.
Yeah, no, I hear you, Rosita. I had the great good fortune to hear her preach, right? And my father was in a previous iteration, he was also a preacher. So he was the Reverend Dr. Archibald Ward, and he would always greet her as the Reverend Doctor, Doctor, Doctor. He would always give her props, you know what I mean? It was similar styles for me in that my father was very scholarly in the times that I heard him preach, and Polly as well. They both brought joy, but it wasn't simple. It was, and in particular Polly's case, the kind of joy, and I don't mean to get mystical here in any way, because there's always rose-colored glasses, and Polly would be the first one to say she had a temper. I never saw it, but she always said she did. She said it came from the Irish side, the Fitzgerald side, I think. But there was a joy when she was speaking about those things spiritual and those things God-related, and my father would say that which is eternal, and she brought to it that legal mind as well. So in a way, it was sort of like dissecting the text, but in the same way, there was a joy that only comes when you have experienced what Polly's experienced, where you somehow still have joy and faith in humanity, when you have to be the first to do almost, blink and everything, right? I mean, honestly, she didn't let that stop her, and she was communicating that to people, many people who had a much easier road than she did. She brought that. She brought that, and that I hear that in her voice when she writes too. There's like a, I don't know if there's a word for like legal prophetic voice, but she had that hopefulness for humanity that she never seemed to have lost despite everything, and despite her own personal pain and what she'd gone through in her life. She kept that. Communicated that beautifully without, and again, St. Philip's was a country church. It was a church of people, most people of not means, right? And but she never talked down to anybody. She was there with you, carrying you on a thought journey, an inspirational journey with her. And I found it really moving.
Yeah, I like the way you mention it's still being able to find joy and express that
Yeah.
even after. And then it's like with the legal mind too, it's like, and yeah, I can kind of see it as proving all these points why you should still be joyful,
Yes. A
evincing
plus
this.
B.
Yeah, and with the faith in that she had for in personally in her own God, and then that extends to humanity as well. For me, it's also been since working at this museum, I've learned pretty much all I know about Pauli Murray from the work that we've done here. So I'm always constantly learning something whenever I look back at her work or reread a text or whatever. There's something new and something always timely.
Right.
Sometimes, unfortunately, still relevant. But
Extremely.
yeah.
I mean, if there one thing I'd say about Polly would be, if there was a underlying subtext, it would be never, 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 never give up. I mean, just get yourself, pick yourself up, keep going. Never. I don't know how you feel about that, Rosita, but that was amazing to me, even when she was ill, and we would travel up to see her, she was still trying to get things finished, trying to finish her for I mean her first autobiography, The Song in a Weary Throat, before it became the Polly Murray, and that came went back to Song in a Weary Throat. But and I knew she was working on a second one as well after that. Like this was the first section, and she had hoped to live to do the next one. And I she still didn't she didn't give up.
She had such perseverance and stick-to-itiveness. That was one of the things I always felt that I mimicked her in. A lot of relatives, most people who know my mother and Aunt Polly or members of the family always say I'm more her daughter than I am my mother's because she made such an impression on me. And I just was so drawn to her interest of helping others and advocating for others and speaking up. My mother was really very different than that. She didn't even really advocate for herself. When I was a very young child, I taught myself to write and to eat with my left hand to emulate Aunt Polly because I was just so impressed by what she had gone through and how she had almost been persecuted, for being a lefty. And I just thought that was awful. It really left an impression on me.
And just in thinking too, Rosita, I don't know, did she ever tell you some of the wonderful witticisms of her Aunt Pauline? You know, some of the jokes, I can't really tell them in the podcast, but let's just say they were hysterical. And we called them, and this is the only part of it I'll say, I promise, Rosita, I won't go into the full joke realm, but they were called little old lady jokes. And it was they were pretty rowdy.
Didn't really her hair down, as I would call it in my day, when she felt comfortable with people and she was around friends and family. She, even though she was very bold and assertive, she was also guarded of who she talked to about certain kinds of things, unless she was defending something. So I got the opportunity, like you did, like your family did, to see her smoke cigarillos from a bottle, smoke a pipe. My mother even ever saw that.
That's interesting, Rosita. Yeah, well, I knew we were friends when she left Roy with us and trusted us with her dog. Did you? I have a question for you, Rosita. What age were you when you read any of her? What age were you when you read Proud Shoes? I know that I read it at 12.
14.
14.
When it had just come out,
Yeah.
first thing I really read about her, read I never saw her poetry till I was an adult. Of course, that came out much later. And now I've seen, the original manuscript and things of that nature in my research. But I knew she was a poet, but I hadn't had the opportunity to see any of it.
I had a chance, my mom and I once talked, as I said, my mom knew Polly much more intimately than I did just because of, I was a kid, right? I enjoyed the heck out of her, but I was a kid and then I was a young adult. But I remember chatting with my mom once about Dark Testament, and she said that in a way that the poems were like prayers, that she found them very, very hopeful. That they provided a guidance. I mean, they showed pain. They showed struggle, but they had that hopefulness about them. And the fact that also Polly later in again, all these firsts, and I'm sure Nate, when you record, put a list of all a lineage of the first that Polly, was, and of course the first female Black Episcopal priest after so many firsts that she had to become because there was no other way for her to keep moving forward unless to do it first. She had that vision. She had that drive. And somehow she kept going.
Yeah.
But I think all her life, she, like you said, Rosita, I mean, her uncle, was a Reverend Small. And, she had that tradition, but she also just had that calling,
Yeah.
and I think it immersed itself in her sense of justice. And I think one of the experiences at St. Philip's before it burned in Akwasca was the justice element of you're there to serve, you're there to help your neighbor. Did someone need a lunch? Did someone need their barn shored up? Who needed painting? It was justice, but it was serving each other, not charity, service. And I think she brought that to everything she did, from my perspective. I was thinking one another phrase of hers that I love was that she lived long enough to see her lost causes found. I love that phrase, but now I'm saddened because they're becoming unraveled. And I think they're still found. Her lost causes are still found. People are fighting. But if Polly was to say something to us right now, I think it would be like, dust yourselves off and get out there.
Yeah.
Do everything you can. Because I think what's happening in our world right now and in our country right now, I think it's been shored up by the work of people like Polly. I don't think it will become unraveled completely because of people of strength and character who has helped formed, the American identity, really. Even if people didn't know Polly. Polly was not a self-promoter. I don't know if you found this to be true, Rosita, but she did not promote herself at all.
Not even to family.
Right. Like, I didn't know all she was until I got older. Even though I knew all these things about her, I didn't know all the things about. I mean, she was not one to ever brag in any way, shape, or form, but also just not even to say, yeah, I was a part of that, or I helped found the National Organization of Women. The only time I heard that was because my mom knew Gloria Steinem, but I wouldn't have had that connection if, you know what I mean, if that hadn't come up. So it was never Polly first, it was the cause first.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I was just thinking about that as you were talking. Yeah, she wasn't writing and creating these works to be known, right? It was
Right.
more to make the cause known, to find that lost cause and
Her poetry and a lot of her writing helped her by getting it out and by saying, and it helped her express herself. And it was also a method of her advocating for others. One of my favorite quotes is very simple, but is one person plus one typewriter constitutes a movement.
another fave.
Always meant a lot to me because I have so many memories of her sitting in front of it, looked like millions of books to me in her office, banging away at a type when she wrote, and she used it for everything. I can remember at Christmas time, we would get these one or two page typed summaries of what she had been doing, but again, not boasting about. So, sort of a summary of her year. And then she would write little notes in her own handwriting. And I did know that she wrote to newspapers, and there were family discussions about the fact that she went to the White House. And that many of my family members had gone to the White House, and that she was a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt. I was one of these children that was like, show me, I'm from Missouri. Even though I heard these kinds of things, if it hadn't touched me personally, or I hadn't seen it personally, I wasn't sure. But I was really. I always knew that she was writing important people and saying things that were on her mind because she was sitting at that typewriter pounding away. And I found out later that she had worn out two typewriters and had three through her lifetime because she really did use them.
She wore them out because, like you said, she was not only writing important points to important people, she was saying it well. She was saying it in a well that was and so well it was hard to ignore. I know we were so fortunate for her to leave us a couple things, as she, before she passed, and she left my sister that last typewriter, and she left me her altar cross. She left my mom the cross that was closest to her heart that hung on her chest. She left my father that wonderful book you just cited that I never can remember, that treatise on the civil rights. So, it was sort of like she kind of knew us. She kind of like said, here's some, and I don't think she ever thought they would be considered precious. She was giving my sister a typewriter for practical reasons. My sister was continuing with her education. She knew that I attended church, and that meant a lot to me. She also considered, at that time I was an actor, and she considered that to be part of the spiritual experience. We had a talk about that in a lovely way. And my mom, she, the two of them loved each other, in a really special way. And my dad was a scholar, so he got that tome. Which I have to say I've never read, but it is sitting on my shelf right now. It's impressive. But again, to her modesty, and that's why we're so glad to be able to share some of those items with you, Nate, and the Writers Museum, so that people get to see kind of physical things.
I was gonna I love the items we have. We have the two crosses you mentioned, the larger altar top one, and then that one she had close to her heart. But then Lucille, tell me again the story with that the leather cord broke off at one point, right?
Right,
And
that's right. And then she used it in like a meditation. So she would, again, and if you see the, when you look at in your exhibit, you can see the, you don't see her parts of wearing it through, but you see the root, the grooves in
the
it.
groove.
Sort of like a rosary, but we don't really do that in the Episcopal tradition, but you know what I mean? It's sort of a contemplative. I would see her do that. Yes, and also we loaned my mom's very tattered copy of Dark Testament because we believe in using books. They're not to be put in pristine on the shelf, but it's wonderfully tattered and it has notes in it. And Polly, when she wrote the inscription to mom in that Dark Testament, just to mom personally, she said something about, I can't even remember because you have it right now, Nate. I can't remember exactly what it says, but it basically, she said something about it rewriting the last stanza of Dark Testament to be friend and sister to every other man. And I think that was, mom was so touched by that. I mean, like that, she just carried that, like, with her. I mean, hey, to have Polly recognize you that way, man.
I know, yeah.
She said,
Again.
I had great dramatic talent. I'll take it.
That is certainly something I would take with me too. And it's interesting that we have these physical items that we're talking about, right? But then there is, I feel like, an aspect in both of you that is a spirit of Polly, or aspects of Polly's spirit that you also carry within your soul and body every day. I'm curious if you both have mentioned what you're currently up to, but maybe talk a little bit more about the work you're currently involved in, and how you see that as kind of carrying the torch from Polly Murray in different ways. And some, Rosita, your mission to spread the word of Polly Murray is great and is very successful. You're always out there on tour. I'm always impressed. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what you have going on.
Well, where do I start? Let me share how it all began. I think around the time that she was deemed a saint in the church, family members started hearing from people that a lot of people were becoming interested in who she was and trying to find out things that she had done that no one knew about. And so that was in 2012. And in 2016, I was asked to join a group from Durham, who was going before the Department of Interior and the Park Service to try to get them to consider her childhood home in Durham as a National Historic Landmark. So that house she lived in from when she was 3 until she graduated from high school. And so I joined them in Washington, and that was one of 3 sessions where they had to amplify who she was and what her importance was in hope that the federal government would be interested. And luckily they were. And so the house was deemed a National Historic Landmark. So the next year I went to Durham to actually see the home and meet the people who for about 6 or 7 years had been working very hard. They had to save the home from the wrecking ball. The city was going to demolish it. And then they had to raise money to rehab it to National Historic Preservation Standard. And then they had to come up with the ideas of why she was important. And so while I was in Durham, I had the opportunity to go to my first feast day. And in the Episcopal Church, when someone is a saint, on the day they die, they are honored, which is called their feast day, which for her was July 1st. So I had gone to Durham to see the center and meet the group, but I did not know that I was arriving on what was her feast day, celebrated by St. Titus, which was a church where Aunt Pauline and Aunt Sally were founding members. So I get to the church, and everyone there is there to celebrate her. And it's like wall-to-wall tapestries and oil and portraits and everything Pauline Murray. And the bishop was there and all kind of, high officials in the church and dignitaries, et cetera. And after it was over, they had the traditional Episcopal ice cream social, as they call it. So my niece and I were there, my niece Rhea, and we were eating our ice cream, and we looked around and we saw all of these people in a long line. And I said to Rhea, I thought everything was over. And she said, I think they're waiting to talk to us. And so this long line of children and elders and dignitaries were literally standing in a line to talk to us. They wanted to share anything they knew about her. People who had met her wanted to tell us about that. People who had never met her just wanted to say what she meant to them. And there were people who just wanted to touch me. They said, can I touch you because you're related to her, or you knew her, or you had the same blood that she had. And I started having an out-of-body experience. I can't describe how it began, but I literally felt like I was floating in clouds and I was in another atmosphere. And after everybody left, my niece and I were waiting for an Uber, and so we were talking, and she said, what's going on in your head? I see the wheels turning. And I said, I just can't explain what just happened. I said, but we aren't involved in anything. And as her blood, we need to support, what others are doing to uplift her legacy. And so that began my, what I call my Pauline Murray epiphany of trying to see how I could help uplift the legacy and bring her out of a hidden figure into people's, knowledge. And I thought, as an elementary school teacher and a reader, that I could write a book. And I thought it would be important to write it for young people so that they could learn about her before they were old and fixed in their ways or what have you. So that began, and that was in 2017. And then after the book came out, I retired and decided I would just go speak about her if I could get anybody to listen. And I'd go anywhere. So I just started letting people know that I was available and writing them and volunteering to speak. And that just sort of began where I am now. I formalized it by creating Preserving Pauli Murray LLC. And I started visiting Episcopal churches and schools and any organization that would have me, and volunteering to participate in anything anybody was doing about Pauli Murray. So I've just kept that up since 2017, and that's become what I call my passion project.
I love, Rosita, the way you say Polly on my shoulder. I always think about you saying that. And it was such a pleasure to meet you when you did come to St. Philip, I mean, to St. Thomas's church. And the interesting thing, too, with St. Thomas Church is, of course, that history of the white church and the black church. So as St. Simon's Mission was just right down the road, and St. Thomas's Church was the quote unquote white church. And I don't think Polly had a good experience there initially, and St. Simon's was where her uncle preached, where your family member preached, Rosita. And the, we still mark that. I mean, I go to St. Thomas, and we still try to, maintain that St. Simon's beautiful graveyard that, you and I visited together, Rosita. But it is interesting too, that laden history, and that brings me into it, right? Because the Southern Maryland National Heritage Area, heritage areas are a really interesting entity. There's only 62 in the entire United States, and you have to have an act of Congress, and you get signed into law by the president. Luckily, that was President Biden, and that's all I'm saying. Her legacy to have that be part of our uplifting the history of this region, of this very rural peninsula with 1,000 miles of shoreline and all these amazing firsts, of which Polly was, a primary part on a personal level. And I think about that too when people find out I knew Polly, it's like a big deal, right? And I only mention it when it's relevant because it's not about me. Right? It's only relevant to the story if it's relevant to the story. But I could just see Polly saying, "Oh, people, stop making such a big deal about it. Just get on with the work." And I can just, and in my life, when things, in terms of trying to make those connections and that meaning, I don't see a separation from what I do in terms of work. It's related to telling the true story, if we can, the full story, the full aspect of our heritage. What makes this region or these people unique, and it's not just a history, right? It's trying to understand that complexity of history and sometimes interpreting it, sometimes correcting it. But it's also just, what do people eat and wear and sing and dance and think about? And there's that joy in that. And I don't know what parts of that with Polly is me, but I would be honored to know that the joy part definitely is a, there's an aspect there of, in the work, because I mean, Rosina knows I'm a tad overworked these days, and we're trying so hard to do a lot of things really fast, and we're also honored that Rosita will allow us occasionally to, do a small sponsorship that, and then she takes our the work that we're doing with her. And that connection's been really important to my organization because she's able to spread the word of the work that Polly does, and that also shines a light on this aspect here in Maryland. I mean, there are parts of Polly's history here in Maryland that are incredibly painful. Her father being at that Crownsville site, and there's a Baltimore connection. I just don't think Maryland is yet fully embraced all that Polly was part of here. And I think not to take away from Durham at all. And I'm so glad that home's been preserved. I know my sister's on the board of that organization with you, Rosita. I think you're on the board as well, right? For the,
Right.
for that center, and I'm so grateful for it. But their focus is not, again, thinking about your exhibit, the spiritual aspects. There's more about, but I don't think Polly would separate, she wouldn't separate the spiritual, that which is godly and that which is justice. I don't think she'd separate it. And I hope we don't.
Yeah, because I think they can inform each other, those aspects that yeah, I'm glad you mentioned also the your work, Lucille, as the sort of full aspect of history, not just some parts of it, and not just the timeline sort of thing, but because I think that's another, like we mentioned, it kind of reminds me of what we were talking about in regards to Polly, how it's a full writer, just the whole all of it. And then as the writer, she's able to write in different avenues, but fully under it's writer, and depending on the medium or the mode or topic, it might take a different form, but it's all related to the same person, which is Pauli Murray. And that, yeah, a constant, ceaseless fight for justice.
Yes, ceaseless.
Yeah.
And that which is right. And it's so interesting too to know that when she came to do her seminary work at St. Philip's and her connection to St. Thomas and St. Simon, well, not St. Thomas, St. Simon's, and all that, Maryland is where, the first time any type of religious freedom was ever put into law in the Western world. And it was a flawed law. It didn't apply to everybody, but it was a start. And it was legal and it was codified. And I think about Polly when I think about that too. What does it mean to be tolerant? And what does religious tolerate? Are we tolerating? Are we embracing difference? Are we allowing? Are we, what aspect is, very top down or bottom up, right? And she was bottom up. she's like, speaking truth to power is the phrase people use, and it's overused. But if there's a better way to say that, and I'm not the writer, I would love to be able to say that, because it's sort of saying, no, you work for us. And I would say, I would think Polly would think internally in, and I work for God. I don't want to put words in Polly's mouth, though. That would not be good.
I've been disappointed that I felt that the state of Maryland hasn't embraced her enough and promoted her enough.
Agreed.
And we're working on that.
Rosie and I are trying. I'm trying to use my
Yeah.
what political, but it's sort of interesting. Here we're talking about the American Writers Museum in Chicago, and we're not having this podcast in Maryland, and we should be having a podcast that is about her work and life, in the state to which she had such an impact. We're working on it. Rosie and I, we're not giving up, even in a snowstorm.
Oh no, yeah. I don't think anything could hold you two back.
I don't know if we have time. I told you one of my favorite quotes, but I'd love to read from a book about her, not by her. It sort of solidified for me things I'd heard from my family about the fact that she did important things, that she knew the first lady and the president. And it also let me know, in her own words from her own journal, that I was important to her. So this is from The Firebrand and the First Lady by Patricia Bell Scott, whom I've met and talked with many times. And this was, you remember, I mentioned that we usually saw for family events. So a week before her visit with Eleanor Roosevelt, Murray attended a family reunion in Baltimore, where her adolescent niece, Rosita, mentioned that she wanted to meet Eleanor Roosevelt. "It's too bad you won't be in New York next Saturday," Murray chuckled, "since I'm having tea with Mrs. R." Murray gave no further thought to the matter until the high schooler called at 6:15 the following Friday morning and announced, "Aunt Polly, Daddy sent me the money and I have bought a new dress for the occasion. Would you meet me at the 751? I'm taking the congressional out this afternoon. Murray promptly got permission to bring her spunky niece, and they arrived at ER's East 62nd Street apartment on the afternoon of December 1st, 1956. Seated around the living room in apt conversation with Eleanor Roosevelt were Israeli Minister of Foreign Affairs Golda Meir, Justine Wise Poilievre, a human rights activist and the first woman judge in New York City, and several Protestant leaders, as I remember, Adam Clayton Powell. Eleanor Roosevelt paused long enough to introduce Paulie and Rosita, and then she returned to the discussion, which focused on the Suez Crisis and the treatment of Jews in Egypt. Because this powerhouse gathering so mesmerized Rosita, it shocked her when ER began emptying the ashtrays, putting back the chairs after the dignitaries left. To see the former First Lady feed bits of cookies to her Scottish Terrier, Mr. Duffy, struck the teenager as odd. Rosita's eyes popped even wider as she watched the most admired woman in the world calmly munching nuts from a dish and in deep conversation about the fate of aid to education, the NAACP, Adam Clayton Powell, the Negro vote, etc., with her Aunt Polly. I never cease to marvel at the greatness of your humanity, Murray wrote to Eleanor after the visit. I shall never forget the picture of you sitting in a moment of respite from world problems, dutifully writing nine autographs for a 14-year-old. When asked what she planned to do with her bounty, Rosita had said, "One for my billfold, one for my scrapbook, one for my boyfriend, one for my best girlfriend, and one for my sister. I'll save the other four for special events." Murray always left visits with ER inspired, but this moment was special, she explained. By contact with with such youngsters, you were projecting the greatness of your spirit into the future many decades. She's one of my favorite nieces, and I think the exposure to current history she got at your home will have a significant effect upon her life. And so I think I was destined, as a result of that visit, to do some of the things that I'm doing now. And Polly is on my shoulder. She keeps me inspired and she helps me through the rough times like we're going through today.
That's beautiful, Rosita. So beautiful. I love that. Yes, I have that book and I read that part about you in it that I thought was so charming. And in referencing what you're saying now, the aspects about Polly about being an American, I mean, I think that's in a particularly important point right now. And I know in our Southern Maryland National Heritage Area, we're having a lot of discussions about, what does liberty mean on this 2026 year of the founding of our country? What is liberty? What is being an American? What does that mean? And we'll have forums and different discussions about it, even though we're being told by some not to, right? We have to take risks and stand in front of trains occasionally to make sure we can all be our best selves. And hearing you read that, it was wonderful, Rosita. And I was looking at thinking about that ending of Proud Shoes, when she was able to, because her grandfather was a Union veteran, she could take the Union flag and plant it at his grave proudly. And where she had was it, this whole rebel atmosphere and these rebel flags, and that yet Polly was determined to plant that American flag there, that meant something. And I remember looking at this one sentence here when she said, "But for that one moment upon this lone flag, I hung my nativity and the right to claim my heritage. I bore mute testimony to the irrefutable fact that I was an American, and it helped to negate in my mind all those symbols of inferiority and apartness." And I think that's a discussion that we all need to be having now. What does that mean? And for Polly to feel that after everything she had to fight for, to be acknowledged as an American and not something separate. I think it's a really big deal, and I think she would be telling us to get to it.
Well, with that, I think we gotta get to it. Putting the last words, leaving with Polly's own words, seems fitting, and I want to thank you both, Rosita and Lucille, for joining me today, and for all the work you've done in general, but also with us specifically at the museum. And for me personally, I've learned a great deal from the both of you as you've transferred what you've learned from Polly down through the generations. It's I have a nephew and three nieces who also live in DC, and maybe one day I'll be like the cool uncle, and they'll be on a podcast talking about me. I don't
Yay. I
know.
hope that's true, Nate. I'm sure it will be. I bet you're a pretty good, a pretty cool uncle now.
But no, I in all truthfulness, I cannot wait till they get well, I guess they're old enough for the children's books, but some of the deeper Polly Murray work too. Like when they're in college, I know I'm going to send them off with some books that'll get them to think and feel. So, and I'm sure our listeners will feel the same way after this. So thank you again.
Thank you, Nate, for the opportunity. What a gift. Thanks so much. And Rosita.
Yes, it was so nice talking with both of you about my favorite subject.
Stay well, you both.
Thank
Okay. Thank you.
you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Nation of Writers, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.